everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. It's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. I tell you, every time I hear that intro music, it reminds me of Starsky and Hutch. I don't know what it is, but today I was like, man, I got to do something different. I want to find something that's cool and neat and, I don't know. The other one seemed a little bit boring, so I figured we'd mix it up a little bit just for the day. But I don't know. Maybe we'll do one of the other ones next time and see if we can find a new one. We'll see what happens. But anyway, welcome back. This is going to be episode 171. And the warm-up song today is going to be Chicken Fried by Zach Brown. And although I haven't had a cold beer on a Friday night in about 4 years, I'm thinking about trying one of those non-alcoholic options that are out there. I think I saw like a Budweiser NA. I think Busch has one. I don't know if I want to drink a Busch beer. That's kind of going too far, but I've heard there's some pretty good non-alcoholic IPAs. So we'll see how that works out. Special thank you to all the Buy Me a Coffee supporters out there. Without you guys, I definitely could not do this. And as I mentioned before, 100% so far of 2025 donations went back into buying newbies for projects, experiments, and things for next year. I am about to kick off my coolest project ever. So after this episode, this Thursday, I'm going to release a Bee Buzz. And then 1 week from today, episode 173 is going to be all about my overwintering monitoring solution. I'm really geeked out about this. I hope that you guys are going to enjoy it. I'm also hoping that once I release that later on that same week, maybe the next week afterwards, I'll do a detailed video showing all the components and the parts. I'm going to put it I'm going to do most of it through Amazon because it's available. The parts are there. You can do things through AliExpress if you have the time and maybe save a few dollars if you're comfortable buying from them. But it's going to be very interesting, and hopefully you can kind of follow along at home. Like I said, I'm going to put everything out there. I'm going to put the software I'm using, the hardware, different things. I think it's just a really fun concept. And I will also try my best. It's a busy winter coming up here, but I will do my best to go through all of the assembly of everything, do videos of it. I'll create a separate playlist on YouTube so you guys can kind of follow along, and we'll just keep everybody updated. As a quick little teaser on that, though, I'm going to be setting up some of it in my garage to do some testing. I'll do some power load testing to kind of assess exactly how much solar we're going to need and the right sized battery. And I will be doing, I'm going to be buying these little heat strips that can generate heat up to like 120, 150 degrees. I'm going to put them all inside of a mock hive in my garage to do a lot of testing. And ultimately, you'll be able to see some of the test data. I should have some of the test data up hopefully by midwinter, because the idea behind this is to get this whole thing into my hives all winter long. And then you guys could just log in, hit the website, and you'd be able to see real time the temperature, you know, approximately where the cluster would be located, depending on the number of sensors. I've got like 60 sensors I think I'm going to have. What I'm doing is, well, I don't want to give it all away. It'll be on the next episode. It'll be on episode 173, and you guys can check it out there. But it's really, really fun and should be kind of neat. So today we're going to talk about the winter cluster. You know, what is this cluster? Why is it forming? What is the purpose behind it? You know, what's going on with the winter cluster? So we'll jump in by talking about, let's just talk visually when you think about a cluster. So I always say that if you've ever seen a swarm or an image of a swarm, or if you haven't, you're brand new and you're like, I'm just thinking about getting into beekeeping. I really don't even know what a swarm is. No idea what you're talking about. If you do a search on your favorite search engine or AI or whatever you like to use to browse and search, just do a search for swarm of honeybees. And you'll see this big cluster of bees hanging from a tree branch or something like that. That is very similar to what a winter cluster looks like inside the hive. What happens is the bees, and I'm going to give you some kind of textbook temperatures. This is not a hard, fast rule. Different races of bees have different tolerances and thresholds for temperature, but around 57 Fahrenheit, 14 degrees Celsius, that's when the bees say, all right, I'm getting a little cold. I need to be able to retain some more heat. So come on, ladies, let's all get together and stay warm. So the bees will shape themselves into a ball and kind of compress into this dense ball around the queen. And if it's a time of year where there's any brood present, of course, they're going to, you know, cluster around the brood as well to protect that. And that's how they're going to maintain themselves over the winter. You know, this is where I always kind of like to describe it. You know, we quite often think of bees as individuals. You know, they are individual honeybees living in a hive, and they are a colony. I think this example, talking about the bees clustering the way they do in the wintertime, I think this really illustrates an excellent example of why the colony really needs to be viewed as kind of a super organism. You know, it's not a bunch of little things. It's one big thing. It's kind of like a person, if you want to think about it that way, where we have individual cells and the cells form tissues and the tissues form organs and this forms everything that is your body. That's very much like what a bee colony is. It is a super organism. And I think when you, I'm taking a look here, here we go, tangent number one. But this is where like a lot of people get upset, like, oh no, I don't want to kill 300 bees to test for mites. You know, I don't want to kill them. Like that's just regular, think of it as cells in your body die all the time and they are replaced with new cells. Think of it like that. You are losing cells and that's a normal process of your body staying alive, getting rid of the old, cycling in the new. Think of it something like that, if that maybe helps for you at all. I don't know if it does. But when we look at the physical cluster and what's going on, I think of it as kind of like a layer of insulation, right? You have, well, go back to like the person, the human kind of dynamic. Think of like the, you have the mantle bees are on the outside, the outer edge, and that temperature out there can get, you know, somewhere between, they generally will keep the outer bees once they start getting down to around that 50 Fahrenheit, so probably like 12 or 13 Celsius. When they start getting down around that temperature range, they're going to try to rotate back into the middle and try and get to where it's warmer. But the mantle bees are all the bees on the outside, on the edge, kind of like your skin, all on the outside. And then all of your core bees are the ones that are near the center. They're closest to the queen. And again, they're interlocking very tightly to kind of form an insulation. And they will continue to turn over and rotate between the mantle and the core to prevent the bees from tiring out, to prevent the ones from the edges at the mantle to getting too cool. And so we'll talk some more about the process and how that all works. But this is generically the cluster. And this, to me, is kind of another thing that is just cool about honeybees and how they operate differently from a lot of other insects. There are a lot of other insects that they don't actually live, you know, over winter. They will lay their eggs or they'll be in some sort of pupating phase or they just completely die. You know, they're not a living organism all winter long, kind of like the honeybees are. I think it's a pretty unique and kind of cool thing. So what's... we're trying to do this in like a who, how, why, what, where type of thing. So one of the big drivers behind the cluster and why they're clustering is conservation of energy. An individual bee can only create so much heat and warmth by herself, but when she's insulated and wrapped around all of her sisters, it certainly makes things a lot easier. Now, I had mentioned what those outer temperatures are and some of those tolerances on the mantle, somewhere in that like, you know, 12, 14 degrees Celsius, 46 to 50-ish Fahrenheit kind of range on the outside. The inner portion of that at the core, you know, they can be somewhere around the 70s. That's not unusual at all. But if they have brood, if it is a time of year where they are, like, for example, in the spring where there's a big spring ramp up and they're adding a lot of new brood and you get some of these cooler nights, they will completely cluster around all that brood to protect it. In fact, I've lost a lot of bees this way because we had a diminishing and a reduction in the size of the cluster size from the winter going into the spring, and they had four or five frames of brood laid up. They didn't have enough bees to adequately cover all of the brood and protect it from the cooler nights. And you know that brood needs to stay in that like around 95 degree Fahrenheit. I think that's, is it 30, I think it's 34, 35, 30, 33, 34, 35 Celsius kind of range. It's got to stay at that temperature for that brood to stay safe and to develop normally. So they will definitely make it higher during those times, which while we're on this subject, think again to how many times we've talked about how vulnerable the coming out of winter time is. And I think this is something that the folks in the Southern Hemisphere are experiencing right now, where you've got a diminishing cluster. You know, some of the bees have died off, you know, just natural attrition over the winter. And more activity is starting to ramp up. They're using the last of their remaining bee bread and pollen resources that might be available to start rearing new brood. And they've got to maintain that warm cluster temperature for that brood. So there is so much going on, a lot of resource intensive activities. And this is where I've said repeatedly that if you are going to do a food intervention of some sort, like that late winter going into spring time frame is really the best time to consider that. But I think the key takeaway with the whole cluster is it's not about keeping an individual bee alive. It's about keeping the entire colony alive. So specifically, how are we generating, or I shouldn't say we because I'm not flapping my wings, but how are the bees generating the heat? How does that actually happen? They have their flight muscles. They're these dorsal, ventral, and dorsal longitudinal muscles in their through their thoracic and abdomen, mostly in the thoracic area. But these muscles are, it's very strong. It's very muscular, a lot of musculature in that area. And those are the muscles that they're using to fly. And essentially, they reverse the order of which those muscles contract and conduct muscular contractions that allows them to shake and vibrate. So they're vibrating the muscles, but not moving the wings, just by using the muscle in a slightly different way. It's kind of like how if you were to do a curl with your arm, I can just flex the muscle in my arm without bending my arm up towards my shoulder. It's the same kind of concept where they're flexing the muscle, but not moving the wing. It's super cool, really neat. And of course, anytime you're dealing with muscle and muscle movement, you're dealing with energy, you're dealing with the use of energy, and you're going to need to fuel this. This is why having that most important and best food resource available, honey, is so critically important. So it's great to have an understanding of what the cluster is, what it's doing, the purpose, kind of how things, activities take place within the cluster. But now the question is, how do we feed the cluster and what does it do? I think we've had discussions on the Discord. I've had them by email multiple times where people are kind of confused as to how the cluster feeds itself, how the bees consume resources, in the wintertime. So the cluster, it kind of moves as a unit throughout the frames of the hive, and it kind of consumes the resources as they go. So it's not, hey, I'm going to run over and get some food. I'll be right back. The cluster will kind of move together. So if you envision sort of a double deep kind of configuration, we'll just say Langstroth 10 frame, very basic configuration, double deep. And in the upper deep, let's just say it's 10 frames of honey. More likely than not, you probably have a scenario where it's like the outer two frames probably have a little bit. They might be packed out. You may have moved some things around and really made sure that all those frames are packed out. But you probably have 9 or 10 frames of honey up top. And you're likely going to have maybe one of those frames or even two of them in the middle. Might be some little bit of brood in there. And then you'll have, hopefully, if it all works out, you'll have the brood space in the middle that's, it could be empty now. They may have had the opportunity to backfill that with some nectar, going into the winter. And hopefully maybe you'll have a little bit of honey on the sides. But they will generally kind of move laterally and work their way up. And they'll finish out the season at the top. When you look at this in a tree, it's really pretty cool because they will, they'll be down at the bottom and they have the brood down there, and then they work their way up and they consume all the resources and they get all the way to the top. And then the weather starts getting nice again and they start laying eggs again, and then they start backfilling with honey and laying eggs all the way down to the bottom. But they're keeping the brood, which is wild. They'll keep it up in that top space where it needs to stay the warmest in the spring. And then as things warm up, they backfill that with honey and move all of their other brood rearing down to the bottom to better regulate temperature. They've got it all figured out. But that cluster will move up, left, right, however it needs to continue having access to the energy of the honey. Eating healthy can feel like a chore sometimes, right? But I've found something that makes it easy and delicious. Washington Red Raspberries. These aren't just any frozen berries. They're grown by family farmers in Washington State, picked at peak ripeness and frozen within hours to lock in nutrients. We're talking fiber, antioxidants, vitamin C, real nutrition with no added sugar, just fruit as nature intended. I toss them into smoothies, stir them into yogurt, and even top my oatmeal with them. They're so fresh and full of flavor, I actually look forward to eating healthier. And honestly, it feels so good knowing I'm supporting American family farms every time I grab a bag, and you'll know they're grown right here in the U.S. because it says so on the package. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at Costco, Kroger, Meijer, and Winco Foods. Look for them in Kirkland's 3-Berry Blend, Smucker's Raspberry Jam, Peanut Butter and Raspberry Uncrustables, or those True Fruit chocolate-covered raspberries I can't stop snacking on. Want recipes, tips, or to see all the places you can find them? Go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Now, there's an area here that I think is a tiny bit controversial, and I can't tell you, like, no, this doesn't happen, and this is, you know, this is a bunch of junk or whatever. I will tell you what I know, what my experience is, and what I think, and I will tell you some of what I've heard that I may not agree with. So I have heard it stated that colonies can starve if they are just inches away from food because the mantle bees, they just can't leave the cluster to cross those cold, empty spaces. You know, now we know that, you know, if it's too cold, the bees aren't going to break the cluster, but that doesn't mean that the cluster can't keep moving. I don't agree with that statement. I think that's wrong. I think that they will continue to explore the entire cavity. I have never had, in my experience, and again, everybody's experiences are different, I have never had a colony where there has been three frames, a healthy colony, like where everything is normal, there's no issues with, you know, varroa, viral issues, other problems. I've never had them not be able to find food. I've never had them say, oh no, I'm stuck right here. I can't go 6 inches to get food. But I've heard this said a few times. I don't know where it comes from. Again, I can't scientifically dispute it. I just think that that doesn't make a lot of sense. But I do think that frame arrangement helps. I think that there are certain things you probably should do, certain things you probably shouldn't do. One thing I'll tell you is that I've had people say before, like, hey, I got this cool idea. I know that in the spring there's going to be a big ramp up. I want to go ahead and add some blank foundation or some empty comb right here in the middle. And then that way, when spring kicks off, man, they'll have this, they can just right away start drawing this new comb right here. And I admire, like, the ingenuity and the thought process and, you know, thinking outside the box and all those things. But you really want to allow them free movement throughout the space in a very normal way. You want to keep contiguous bands of honey, and you just don't want to have, you don't want to introduce any kind of risk or discomfort or anything that jeopardizes the overall well-being of the colony. So keep the honey together. Don't try to get too crazy with that. So I think that this would lead into an opportunity to talk about maybe some what not to do's. So we have a lot of questions that come up around, hey, you know, we're getting ready to go into the wintertime. And this is actually, some of these I think might even be part of our upcoming bee buzz, but we're going to answer them anyway here because it's kind of important. People will say, well, hey, we're going into the winter. What do I do with my configuration? I've got two deeps and three, you know, honey supers on right now. And this leads into a really challenging question and answer kind of thing, where if you look at the last couple episodes where we've been talking about insulation and what happens in the high in a cavity in a tree, some more natural things and different options. I think that there are so many variables involved that it makes it incredibly difficult to tell you what to do, to say, oh, you should be in this configuration. I know people in extreme Arctic conditions that are overwintering a single deep and they're doing it year after year after year with no issues. I know people in relatively temperate mid-Atlantic kind of areas that can't figure it out on double deeps, right? And I'm not saying that that's like the norm or the standard. I'm just saying that there are outliers and things that happen that don't work out in areas that are completely different and nowhere near as extreme. So the first thing I say is, or recommend, I would say, is don't rearrange the frames too much in the winter unless you really know what you're doing. If you know exactly what the layout is, and the layout's not tricky and it's not difficult, but they've already got it where they want it. So that's where I say, like, start thinking about your winter configuration maybe a full month before you're going into the times where it's too cold for them to be doing a lot of work. They will, unfortunately, they're very diligent. They will move things where they want them. So if you come in, you disrupt things, they will spend a lot of energy moving everything back to where they want it to be. And unfortunately, if it gets too late in the season, it'll be too cold and they'll just have to deal with it. But you don't want to put any undue stress on the colony that you can avoid. Like I mentioned before about the foundation thing. So if you look inside of a natural hive, the honey, the comb that's drawn on the edges, any of the honey will absorb a little bit of heat, which is kind of cool that it has some insulating properties to it by itself. But that will actually serve, those edges of honey will serve as even additional insulation against the sides of the tree or the cavity. Your frame, if you say, well, look, you know, I want them to draw up this comb or whatever, I'll just throw this on the outside. Your individual frame is better than nothing. It would be ideal to have something between maybe the wall and the rest of the bees in the middle. But ideally, you want the density of drawn comb. You want everything that they've done all spring, summer long, you want that in there. So if you can have everything completely drawn out, ideally packed with resources, great. You want to keep that in place. But don't try to get, you know, don't try to get ahead of the game and be like, cool, we'll drop some foundation all over the place here. And when they wake up in the spring, they can get to work. Save that for like a, you know, northern hemisphere. Save that for like your March, April kind of work. Now, the other thing that you need to be doing is staying aggressive. Like I said, I'm kind of weird about this and I kind of get beat up a little bit by it. And maybe I'm justified in that abuse, but I feed bees if needed in the season. So I'm recognizing what's going on, you know, through the summer dearth, if I'm at the house, through the regular seasons, you know, down in Carolina. And I can kind of see and gauge roughly like, okay, I think we're going to need a little bit more here. We're going to need to do some feeding. But by the time we get to the fall flow area at like this time of year, I would still feed right now. If I had a colony that needed food right now, I would still be providing them feed. And the general rule that I take with that is, you know, when they stop taking it up, just get it out. And, you know, don't leave it in there too long. We are now in the cooler temperatures where the fermentation is a little bit, you know, less. It still is a viable issue, a real concern, but it's not as stinking hot as it is in the summertime. So it takes a little bit longer for those processes to take place. But you still don't want to be leaving unsupervised sugar syrup in there. If they're not taking it up, get it out. And feeding them going into the winter, I think, makes a lot of sense to help them build up. And they will build up very quickly. If you're using 2-to-1 sugar syrup and you've got a strong colony, they will pack away that syrup very quickly. And the other thing you want to do, too, is we've talked about, you know, ventilation. This is just, again, to overall hive health, not specifically to a cluster. But we talk about ventilation. You do want to have some cool air coming in, you know, from the bottom. But definitely, I don't recommend going wide open. It's not that the bees can't figure a way to work it out, but that is a lot of cool air coming in. And consider to make sure that you're looking out for your entrance. What do you call them? Your mouse guards and things. That's really going to be driven by where you live and the types of things, critters and things you have crawling around. But definitely getting mouse guards on early. As long as the bees are still very active, they tend to keep things in check. But if a mouse gets into the hive, like, they're not going to pick it up and drag it out. Like, they're just going to propolize all around it to prevent it from, you know, any kind of disease it might be carrying or transmitting or whatever. They want a nice, healthy, hygienic hive. They will propolize it all over. If you've ever seen an image of it, it's kind of gross, funky, weird, but yet still kind of cool because that's what bees are. So you're going to have to intervene to get that out of there. And you really don't want to be doing that at times of year when it's too cold to be inside the hive. So try to get those mouse guards on a little bit earlier if you need to. And then also, of course, considering any hive insulation that might be necessary if you are in some of these cooler climates that can benefit from that. So quick recap here. The cluster is going to form whenever the temperature outside is, you know, somewhere in that 57-ish degrees Fahrenheit, you know, 14 Celsius. You know, really kind of almost lower is more my experience, closer to that like 52 degree kind of range. But anywhere in that area is a good ballpark of when the bees are going to start forming a cluster. They're going to be generating heat by shivering those flight muscles. They're going to fuel that with honey. And like I said, the cluster is going to move slowly throughout the entire colony, consuming resources out as it goes. And your job as a beekeeper is to try to get them fed and ramped up for the winter. Make sure they've got plenty of resources inside the hive. Don't let funky, weird things climb in and access the hive from the outside. Don't rearrange things. Don't mess up what they've done. They've figured out what they want to do. We'll answer some more details in the Bee Buzz as far as specifics of moving things around and what you should or shouldn't do. I did say today, hey, if you know what you're doing and you know how to do it, go ahead. But if you don't, probably not. We'll talk about that in that Bee Buzz, about some of the kind of best practices and the ways to move those frames and hive bodies to places where they can be best utilized. And last little thing here on the subject, you know, I think that the cluster of bees, to me, I think that this really demonstrates one of the coolest things in nature, just this ability to come together as one big organism. I think it's just really incredible what they do. And this is just one example of that. So I hope that this gives a good overview. Like I said, it comes up every now and then as a subject. And I think that maybe there's not a lot of clarity with it. And this is still pretty much a very, I don't know, 100, 200 level tops kind of discussion. There's just not a lot of advanced, that I'm aware of, a lot of advanced clustering kind of discussions. However, there are discussions to be had around how this is conducted, how they manage this, and how temperature and thermodynamics and things take place in your horizontal hives. So I think this is still a discussion worth having, and I think we're going to need to dedicate an entire section just to discussing some of the pros and cons with that type of approach. So thank you again to all the Buy Me a Coffee supporters. Thank you, Eric, this week for your support. I appreciate that. Check out bestbeekeepinggear.com. We got a couple of reviews and things. There's been some recent discussions that have popped up again around Varroa. So there's a lot of new introductory, what is Varroa, types of things to check out on the bestbeekeepinggear.com site under, I think it's like a start here section, and then there's all about Varroa. Definitely worth reading. Also, check out the Healing Hive Project. It's just thehealinghiveproject.org, a little nonprofit we're trying to do some work with and help out veterans and first responders. All right, everybody, that's all I got for you today. Take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.